Dear, how are you? Good evening. Today's Wednesday. You can call in. The number in studio is 0832 888 401. And my name is Elizabeth. And welcome to Eagle FM here tonight. Tonight is Wednesday, and it is the 3rd of the 9th month, 2025. And it is also 4 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. And also today we are going to be talking about betrayal trauma. Or betrayal syndrome, because I think that many of you people, you are having problems, and I think that you people, that you were betrayed a lot by many, many other people, so that is why I'm here today. I'm here today, teacher, to give you guys lessons. My name is Elizabeth, and I am your host for this evening. All right, the number in studio is 0832 888 401, and you guys can call in officially. We have a caller. The caller did not call through. We have another caller. The caller is cutting. We have another caller. The caller is cutting. Maybe the callers, they must stop calling like that and just cutting. Don't make a missed call. Just call, because me, I cannot see if this is a cell phone or it's a landline or it's maybe a WhatsApp. I cannot see that because me, I'm working with the monitor. The monitor is called the mixer, where I can see my voice. When it is red, it's bad. When it is green, it is good. When it's yellow, it's almost like you're going to be bad, but you're not going to be bad yet. So, we are talking about betrayal trauma. Betrayal trauma is not a really word. It is not a clinical term or anything. It is just a reference to many, many clusters of symptoms, ne? Or within the psychology of a human being that causes them distress. It can also be called post-betrayal trauma or syndrome. And then this one is also usually a result of being traumatized by somebody's betrayal. Symptoms can include anxiety, depression, PTSD-like symptoms, intrusive thoughts, hypervigilance, difficulty trusting, and distorted sense of self. As the betrayal challenges, you fundamentally sense that there is no safety and there is no identity. We have a caller, this caller today. Today, I don't know why you people are, you are giving miss call. I cannot see miss call, please. Please just call in at time and then I answer and then I say, Ingle FM, hello. Welcome, please. Welcome. All right. So, what is betrayal trauma? A betrayal trauma is a type of trauma that occurs when someone you trust, you know, when you trust someone, you love them, you trust them, you believe in them, and you depend on them, maybe even for survival, those people, they turn around and then they stab you in the back. Now we understand why they say backstabbers. Backstabbers will remain what? Cockroaches. Even the dog said that. The dog is from Naena. Okay. Alright, so before we continue with this impulsive decision to be this person today, let us go for a quick break, and then the matriarch will come in herself, and then she will just come and finish the show. Thank you very much for having me. My name is Elizabeth, and thank you.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My-
All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Ladies and gentlemen, we're generally talking about betrayal trauma, and we're talking about betrayal trauma in the sense of it being a syndrome. Now, we have dived into the different narratives around betrayal trauma. We've also dived into the different spaces and spheres in our lives where we could most probably feel betrayed. We could feel betrayed by individuals. We could feel betrayed by institutions, caregivers, loved ones, partners, and all of that. But what does it do to us? That is what we are supposed to be tackling tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, we're jumping into our first conversation around betrayal trauma. And tonight we are joined by Dr. Doug Wavis. Dr. Doug Wavis, and he is going to tell us what happens to our brains when we face betrayal trauma. But also, ladies and gentlemen, please take note that we as Eagle FM, we as Eagle Media House, do not, under any circumstances, claim ownership or rights of any of the information that we display here in terms of audio or visuals on this program. We do not claim ownership rights to it. It is strictly for illustration and demonstration purposes. We thank you.
What betrayal trauma does to your brain. When someone has been betrayed, let's talk about what betrayal is. Betrayal, we think of course, someone cheating on you, seeing prostitutes, having an affair with your best friend, someone at work, or you're a husband and your wife has cheated on you with your best friend or neighbor or someone like that. That's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think of betrayal trauma. We call it partner betrayal trauma. If you want to Google that, partner betrayal trauma, you'll find we've done a lot of research on that. And infidelity is part of that. That's one part of betrayal trauma. Another part of partner betrayal trauma is pornography. You think you're living in this great life and you find that your spouse is using pornography and that you're not enough and that what you believed about them isn't true. And then you find out the stuff they're into and it makes it worse and your whole life goes upside down. But then there's also a third part of betrayal trauma. The next partner betrayal trauma is intimacy anorexia. You're married to someone who doesn't give you their heart. They're too busy for you. They blame you. They withhold love. They withhold praise. They use anger and silence. If they have sex, they're not connected or they're not having sex with you. They can't share their feelings with you. And you feel neglected, alone, and unwanted in your own marriage or your relationship. That's another form of trauma. And that part of betrayal trauma is interesting because all three of these traumas have the same statistical impact on the person. Now, I'm going to get to the brain in just a few minutes, but what this does is it can cause depression, weight gain, or weight loss. It can cause a shutdown of them spiritually and emotionally. It can cause PTSD symptoms, I mean, to the 80 or 90 percentile on those symptoms, intrusive thoughts, dreams, not wanting to go out and connect with other people, shutting down. The amount of impact that partner betrayal trauma has on the human spirit, soul, and body is massive. When someone's been betrayed, it's like they've been hit by a truck, but there's no blood anywhere. They're crushed inside. Their spirit's crushed. Their past is crushed. Who they thought they were to this person, who they thought that person was, the holidays, the vacations, the birthdays, all tainted by now a new narrative, a new story. Their present is destroyed because they don't know what they're going to do. Who is this person? Who am I? Do I have the courage to go forward with them? Do I have the courage to leave them? These are all questions that now existentially they have to ask that they never thought of before. The whole rug has been taken out from under them and they've planted their face on the floor and they're out. They don't know what's real anymore. And if that's not bad enough, their future is destroyed. Financially, they could be totally in a different place. If they leave, if they stay, do they put up with it? Is a person going to get help? Are my kids going to know? Are they going to not know? Are they going to turn out the same way? All of these fears about the future now run on them all the time. So betrayal trauma, Partner betrayal trauma is huge. And it affects all of you, spirit, soul, and body. Okay, and if that's not enough, when betrayal occurs, your brain, I'm talking about the gray matter between your ears, your brain begins to operate in different ways. The fear center fires up and it can stay stuck, fired up, creating a man or woman to be hyper-vigilant, trying to check everything out, making sure everything's safe, make sure they monitor their phone and their computers and where they go and their cars. That's a result of your brain being traumatized. Restlessness, anxiety, and a sense of perpetually being in a protect mode or a guard mode. This alters your ability to regulate your emotions and your mood, to be able to calm yourself down. It's like this app is running in your brain all the time, 24/7. It affects the way you think. It affects the way you actually can reason through problems. And even affects the way you can make decisions and whether they're intelligent or not. Your fear center hijacks your normal functioning and you find yourself in a world where every task feels challenging. Your mind will not stop. It races constantly. You know, you go to pick up the kids, you're waiting for 5 minutes, and all of a sudden downloads of all the feelings and thoughts about what you now know as your life. Your emotions can feel out of control. You've never cursed. You've never yelled. You've never been violent. And you find yourself doing all of the above. Your brain has been impacted. And your coping skills are stretched to the very limit because this is a whole nother way of having to live. It can also go into that fight mode, okay, where you're just going to, all your resources are going to be solving the problem. How do we get him help? How do we get her help? What do we need to do? What's the next thing? How do we make sure this never happens again? And you're moving into that fight gear. We're going to fight for this. And it's all about that. And other parts of your life get smaller. You can also freeze. And I'm telling you this stuff because in our office, and I've been doing intensives for partner betrayal trauma for over 20 years. I'm the father of the partner betrayal trauma movement. I've done more for women and men in this movement than any single person on the planet. And I have great compassion for the trauma that you have experienced. It's massive, it's multidimensional, and it actually does affect your brain. And I have clients, they fly in, they do intensives here at Heart to Heart Counseling Center, but we also in the building have a neuromodulation, and where they go for 5 days and their brain gets assessed, and it's amazing how it'll be either all the way to the left or all the way to the right. And if you're a woman, you are affected by trauma 2.6 times greater than men, because the way your brain is made, when it gets fried worse than men. And so it can really, you can feel like you're not yourself. You can feel like you're not functioning at like even 70%. And if that's you, that neuromodulation treatment might be really helpful. Call our office. But what happens is your brain can go this way or this way, but it's not balanced. And I've seen a lot of ladies who are very stuck, and they can't get out of that gear about the trauma. And over the few days, they become more neuroplastic. The brain begins to be able to solve problems instead of staying stuck in one. And I can literally see in their eyes the difference and the way their brain is functioning. And what's really neat is at the end of the week, they get this report and it says, here was your brain on Monday and here was your brain on Friday.
Alrighty. So ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about betrayal syndrome. Now, what is it? It is basically a series of symptoms that show themselves when you have gone through betrayal, when somebody has betrayed you so deeply that, you can't fathom it and you can't digest it as just an ordinary day. So you go through processes of grief, you go through processes of mourning, you go through processes of anger, you literally just have this great sense of loss, this great sense of depression, and this great sense of anxiety as well. So what exactly happens in order for us to say that, oh no, I'm going through betrayal trauma? It's usually when somebody, that's close to you or somebody that you trusted. You know, you can trust anybody. You can trust an institution. You can trust, individuals as well. to just not do you dirty. And then when they turn around and do you dirty, that is where the juice is. So ladies and gentlemen, how do we survive betrayal trauma? Because this is a continuation of yesterday's conversation. We're going to dive right into what the experts say or what people's experiences are. And then we'll take it from there with story time and rethinking our identities.
Ever to lie to them. And on that night, I lied. 18. 18- It was 2:30 a.m. and my father was banging on the door of this guy's house that I was in. In that moment, I knew everything about our relationship would change. You see, my parents had one cardinal rule, and that was never to lie to them. And on that night, I lied. 18 years of building a foundation of trust was disrupted with this one act, this one situation, this one lie. And as I was preparing to leave for college in 3 days, I was terrified because I did not know what my new relationship would look like with my parents. According to me, I was their favorite child, and I never gave them issues. So this was brand new territory for me. Now, I'm not new to the idea of betrayal. If you're any American girl that's gone through middle school and high school, you've had some backstabbing and thought someone was your friend. I was very comfortable being betrayed, because I could blame how I felt on someone else. However, I could not wrap my mind around being the one causing pain. So like most people, when situations happen, you don't talk about it. You sweep it under the rug. So as I have had the honor of providing therapeutic services for children, individuals, families, couples, I realized one thing. The crux of most dysfunction was rooted in betrayal. Whether it was abandonment, infidelity, neglect, it became those family secrets or those family turmoils. And again, people just did not talk about it. We're very used or okay with the idea of being hurt. But what I've realized in my career is that we do not know how to resolve the hurt. Now, many of us, we practice this thing called emotional cutoffs. I'll give you an example. My cutoff game is strong. Yep, if that was you, just look forward. We know that's not how you operate. Or I'll never talk to that person again. Or she is dead to me. Now, while this may sound like a beautiful way to protect yourself, it isn't. It's a beautiful way to avoid pain, but avoiding pain does not allow you to resolve the issue. So whatever pain is not resolved in one relationship, it will follow you to the next relationship and the next relationship, and it becomes cyclical. So today, I want to offer you three techniques that can help you start your journey on surviving this thing called betrayal. So number one, no one owes you anything. I felt the collective eye roll in this section right here. Now, I know that does not sound therapeutic at all, but the reality is this. You may not ever get closure from the person that hurt you. So you cannot live your life waiting for permission and to be forgiven. You have to be the advocate for yourself and give yourself closure. Well, how do I do that, Dr. Roz? I'm glad you asked. You have to have a very honest moment about what that betrayal has done to you. How are you functioning in your betrayal? How do you feel? What are you feeling? What are you expressing? How are you behaving? Because once you pinpoint how the betrayal has affected you, now you have your starting point on knowing where to heal. So if you feel guilt, if you feel shame, if you feel powerless, now you know where to begin. Now you know where you need to start the healing process. So be your own advocate and give yourself closure. Number two, it's not all about you. Now, I know you guys are probably like, is this lady really a therapist? Because none of this sounds therapeutic. But the reality is, sometimes you are just casualty of war to someone's decision and to someone's behavior. You have to look at the intention of why someone may have done something that they did. So in the psychological world, we use this technique called reframing. And in reframing, what we do is that we look at every perspective of the situation. And you begin to understand why someone may have done what they've done. So here's an example. How many of you are mothers, parents? How many times have you asked your child, why would you do something like that? And how many times have they said, oh, no. And then you walk around like, Father God, who is this that I'm raising? Please let them be a productive citizen. Right? But here's the truth. Children who do not know how to cope with disappointment, how to express emotions, or understand their behaviors, they become adults who do not know how to cope with disappointment, express their emotions, or understand their behavior. So when they do something, some people really do not know why they did it. Take my situation with my parents. That night that they caught me at the young man's house, it was not my intentions to betray my parents that night. I had missed my curfew, and in my little limited 18-year-old mind, I told myself, go ahead, keep the party going. So, of course, when I had this conversation with my parents several years later, my father asked, why would you think that that was a good idea? What do you think I told him? No. Oh, no. Because in that moment, it wasn't about them. I just wanted to be rebellious and celebrate going off to college. And I was too embarrassed as someone who was about to go be a freshman to say that I still had an 11 o'clock p.m. curfew. So again, you have to look at the intentions of what people are doing and reframe it to understand the perspective. Thirdly, forgiveness. Not forget, because I see you guys doing the heavy side, like, really, lady, we have to forgive people that hurt us. I understand when you feel pain that it's very hard to forgive someone. But the reality is, forgiveness is not about them at all. It's not giving them a pass. Forgiveness is for you. Because here's how you know that you're still in that pain. When you see the person on Facebook or Instagram living their best life, and you immediately roll your eyes and you immediately get upset, and you immediately get a migraine, and then you just have to shut it all down. Because that person has not apologized to you for making you feel pain. Energy is never created or destroyed. Allowing that negative energy from whatever betrayal that they've done to you is an affront to your potential, your goals, and your dreams. You are worth more than having anxiety, stressed, being depressed because of something that someone did to you. If you don't remember anything else today, remember this. You cannot control anyone else's behaviors. And also, you do not have to carry the burden of someone else's behavior.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Want to know about...
You're carrying the burden of someone else's choice, which is not fair at all to you. So today, I challenge you to be bold enough to know that you are not powerless. You do not need permission from someone who has done you wrong to heal. Because here's the truth. Looking for healing in the place where you've been hurt will never be beneficial for you. You are responsible for your healing. You are responsible for your healing. Be brilliant enough to understand that you are not what someone has done to you. You are not your mistakes. Now is the time for you to recognize that you are amazing, that you are powerful, that you have everything in you that makes you who you are. You don't have to walk around in pain. You have tools now to help you. So my friends, on today, I pray and I hope that you've heard something that will help you on your journey to surviving betrayal. Thank you.
Surviving a betrayal, surviving betrayal. But then who are we afterwards? And this is a question that arose when a lady was getting divorced. She was getting divorced and it was not a pretty thing. But then after the divorce, she was sitting in her house and she was thinking to herself, but who am I now? Who am I now after I'm not a married woman? I'm like, am I a divorcee? Do I identify as a divorcee? Am I just a divorced woman now? And you know how society frowns upon divorce and frowns upon you not being able to stick it out through somebody else's nonsense or your own nonsense or whatever reason you guys are choosing to separate ways. And she felt stigmatized and she felt like abandoned by society, you know, because it seemed as if everybody was looking at her and thinking like, oh, that one, what do you identify as? And I think that that's where our next speaker comes in and sets the record straight.
Why do we cheat? And why do happy people cheat? And when we say infidelity, what exactly do we mean? Is it a hookup, a love story, paid sex, a chat room, a massage with happy endings? Why do we think that men cheat out of boredom and fear of intimacy, but women cheat out of loneliness and hunger for intimacy? And is an affair always the end of a relationship? For the past 10 years, I have traveled the globe and worked extensively with hundreds of couples who have been shattered by infidelity. There is one simple act of transgression that can rob a couple from their relationship, their happiness, and their very identity, an affair. And yet, this extremely common act is so poorly understood. So this talk is for anyone who has ever loved. Adultery has existed since marriage was invented, and so too the taboo against it. In fact, infidelity has a tenacity that marriage can only envy, so much so that this is the only commandment that is repeated twice in the Bible. Once for doing it, and once just for thinking about it. So how do we reconcile what is universally forbidden, yet universally practiced? Now, throughout history, men practically had a license to cheat, with little consequence, and supported by a host of biological and evolutionary theories that justified their need to roam. So the double standard is as old as adultery itself. But who knows what's really going on under the sheets there, right? Because when it comes to sex, the pressure for men is to boast and to exaggerate. But the pressure for women is to hide, minimize, and deny. Which isn't surprising when you consider that there are still 9 countries where women can be killed for straying. Now, monogamy used to be one person for life. Today, monogamy is one person at a time. I mean, many of you probably have said, I am monogamous in all my relationships. We used to marry and had sex for the first time, but now we marry and we stop having sex with others. The fact is that monogamy had nothing to do with love. Men relied on women's fidelity in order to know whose children these are and who gets the cows when I die. Now, everyone wants to know what percentage of people cheat. I've been asked that question since I arrived at this conference. It applies to you. But the definition of infidelity keeps on expanding. Sexting, watching porn, staying secretly active on dating apps. So because there is no universally agreed upon definition of what even constitutes an infidelity, estimates vary widely, from 26% to 75%. But on top of it, we are walking contradictions. So 95% of us will say that it is terribly wrong for our partner to lie about having an affair, but just about the same amount of us will say that that's exactly what we would do if we were having one. Now, I like this definition of an affair. It brings together the 3 key elements. A secretive relationship, which is the core structure of an affair. An emotional connection to one degree or another. And a sexual alchemy. And alchemy is the key word here. Because the erotic frisson is such that the kiss that you only imagine giving can be as powerful and as enchanting as hours of actual lovemaking. As Marcel Proust said, it's our imagination that is responsible for love, not the other person. So it's never been easier to cheat, and it's never been more difficult to keep a secret. And never has infidelity exacted such a psychological toll. When marriage was an economic enterprise, infidelity threatened our economic security. But now that marriage is a romantic arrangement, infidelity threatens our emotional security. Ironically, we used to turn to adultery. That was the space where we sought pure love. But now that we seek love in marriage, adultery destroys it. Now, there are three ways that I think infidelity hurts differently today. We have a romantic ideal in which we turn to one person to fulfill an endless list of needs, to be my greatest lover, my best friend, the best parent, my trusted confidant, my emotional companion, my intellectual equal. And I am it. I'm chosen. I'm unique. I'm indispensable. I'm irreplaceable. I'm the one. And infidelity tells me I'm not. It is the ultimate betrayal. Infidelity shatters the grand ambition of love. But if throughout history, infidelity has always been painful, today it is often traumatic because it threatens our sense of self. So my patient Fernando, he's plagued. He goes on, I thought I knew my life. I thought I knew who you were, who we were as a couple, who I was. Now I question everything. Infidelity, a violation of trust, a crisis of identity. Can I ever trust you again, he asks. Can I ever trust anyone again? And this is also what my patient Heather is telling me when she's talking to me about her story with Nick, married, two kids. Nick just left on a business trip. And Heather is playing on his iPad with the boys when she sees a message appear on the screen. Can't wait to see you. Strange, she thinks. We just saw each other. And then another message. Can't wait to hold you in my arms. And Heather realizes these are not for her. She also tells me that her father had affairs, but her mother, she found one little receipt in the pocket and a little bit of lipstick on the collar. Heather, she goes digging and she finds hundreds of messages and photos exchanged and desires expressed. The vivid details of Nick's two-year affair unfold in front of her in real time. And it made me think, affairs in the digital age, a death by a thousand cuts. But then we have another paradox that we're dealing with these days. Because of this romantic ideal, we are relying on our partner's fidelity with a unique fervor. But we also have never been more inclined to stray. And not because we have new desires today, but because we live in an era where we feel that we are entitled to pursue our desires. Because this is the culture where I deserve to be happy. And if we used to divorce because we were unhappy, today we divorce because we could be happier. And if divorce carried all the shame, today, choosing to stay when you can leave is the new shame. So Heather, she can't talk to her friends because she's afraid that they will judge her for still loving Nick. And everywhere she turns, she gets the same advice. Leave him. Throw the dog on the curb. And if the situation was reversed, Nick would be in the same situation. Staying is the new shame. So if we can divorce, why do we still have affairs? Now, the typical assumption is that if someone cheats, either there's something wrong in your relationship or wrong with you. But millions of people can't all be pathological. The logic goes like this. If you have everything you need at home, then there is no need to go looking elsewhere. Assuming that there is such a thing as a perfect marriage that will inoculate us against wanderlust. But what if passion has a finite shelf life? What if there are things that even a good relationship can never provide, if even happy people cheat, what is it about? The vast majority of people that I actually work with are not at all chronic philanderers. They are often people who are deeply monogamous in their beliefs, and at least for their partner. But they find themselves in a conflict between their values and their behavior. They often are people who have actually been faithful for decades, but one day they cross a line that they never thought they would cross, and at the risk of losing everything. But for a glimmer of what? Affairs are an act of betrayal, and they are also an expression of longing and loss. At the heart of an affair, you will often find a longing and a yearning for an emotional connection, for novelty, for freedom, for autonomy, for sexual intensity, a wish to recapture lost parts of ourselves, or an attempt to bring back vitality in the face of loss and tragedy. And I'm thinking about another patient of mine, Priya, who is blissfully married, loves her husband, and would never want to hurt the man. But she also tells me that she's always done what was expected of her. Good girl, good wife, good mother, taking care of her immigrant parents. Priya, she fell for the arborist who removed the tree from her yard after Hurricane Sandy. And with his truck and his tattoos, he's quite the opposite of her. But at 47, Priya's affair is about the adolescence that she never had. And her story highlights for me that when we seek the gaze of another, it isn't always our partner that we are turning away from, but the person that we have ourselves become. And it isn't so much that we're looking for another person as much as we are looking for another self. Now, all over the world, there is one word that people who have affairs always tell me. They feel alive. And they often will tell me stories of recent losses, of a parent who died, and a friend that went too soon, and bad news at the doctor. Death and mortality often live in the shadow of an affair because they raise these questions. Is this it? Is there more? Am I going on for another 25 years like this? Will I ever feel that thing again? And it has led me to think that perhaps these questions are the ones that propel people to cross the line, and that some affairs are an attempt to beat back deadness and an antidote to death. And contrary to what you may think, affairs are way less about sex and a lot more about desire. Desire for attention, desire to feel special, desire to feel important. And the very structure of an affair, the fact that you can never have your lover, keeps you wanting. That in itself is a desire machine, because the incompleteness, the ambiguity, keeps you wanting that which you can't have. Now, some of you probably think that affairs don't happen in open relationships, but they do. First of all, the conversation about monogamy is not the same as the conversation about infidelity. But the fact is that it seems that even when we have the freedom to have other sexual partners, we still seem to be lured by the power of the forbidden. That if we do that which we are not supposed to do, then we feel like we're really doing what we want to. And I've also told quite a few of my patients that if they could bring into their relationships one-tenth of the boldness, the imagination, and the verve that they put into their affairs, they probably would never need to see me. So how do we heal from an affair? Desire runs deep. Betrayal runs deep. But it can be healed. And some affairs are death knells for relationships that were already dying on the vine. but others will jolt us into new possibilities. The fact is the majority of couples who have experienced affairs stay together. But some of them will merely survive, and others will actually be able to turn a crisis into an opportunity. They'll be able to turn this into a generative experience. And I'm actually thinking even more so for the deceived partner, who will often say, you think I didn't want more, but I'm not the one who did it. But now that the affair is exposed, they too get to claim more, and they no longer have to uphold the status quo that may not have been working for them that well either. I've noticed that a lot of couples in the immediate aftermath of an affair, because of this new disorder that may actually lead to a new order, will have depths of conversations with honesty and openness that they haven't had in decades. And partners who were sexually indifferent find themselves suddenly so lustfully voracious they don't know where it's coming from. Something about the fear of loss will rekindle desire and make way for an entirely new kind of truth. So, when an affair is exposed, what are some of the specific things that couples can do? We know from trauma that healing begins when the perpetrator acknowledges their wrongdoing. So, for the partner who had the affair, for Nick, one thing is to end the affair, but the other is the essential, important act of expressing guilt and remorse for hurting his wife. But the truth is that I have noticed that quite a lot of people who have affairs may feel terribly guilty for hurting their partner, but they don't feel guilty for the experience of the affair itself. And that distinction is important. And Nick, he needs to hold vigil for the relationship. He needs to become for a while the protector of the boundaries. It's his responsibility to bring it up. Because if he thinks about it, he can relieve Heather from the obsession and from having to make sure that the affair isn't forgotten. And that in itself begins to restore trust. But Heather, or deceived partners, it is essential to do things that bring back a sense of self-worth. To surround oneself with love and with friends and activities that give back joy and meaning and identity. But even more important is to curb the curiosity to mine for the sordid details. Where were you? Where did you do it? How often? Is she better than me in bed? Questions that only inflict more pain and keep you awake at night. And instead, switch to what I call the investigative questions. The ones that mine the meaning and the motives. What did this affair mean for you? What were you able to express or experience there that you could no longer do with me? What was it like for you when you came home? What is it about us that you value? Are you pleased this is over? Every affair will redefine a relationship, and every couple will determine what the legacy of the affair will be. But affairs are here to stay, and they're not going away. And the dilemmas of love and desire, they don't yield just simple answers of black and white and good and bad and victim and perpetrator. Betrayal in a relationship comes in many forms. There are many ways that we betray our partner, with contempt, with neglect, with indifference, with violence. Sexual betrayal is only one way to hurt a partner. In other words, the victim of an affair is not always the victim of the marriage. Now, you've listened to me, and I know what you're thinking. She has a French accent. She must be pro-affair. So you're wrong. I am not French. And I'm not pro-affair. But because I think that good can come out of an affair, I have often been asked this very strange question: would I ever recommend it? Now, I would no more recommend you to have an affair than I would recommend you to have cancer. And yet we know that people who have been ill often talk about how their illness has yielded them a new perspective. The main question that I've been asked since I arrived at this conference when I say I do a talk about infidelity is for or against? I said yes. I look at affairs from a dual perspective. Hurt and betrayal on one side. Growth and self-discovery on the other. What it did to you and what it meant for me. And so when a couple comes to me in the aftermath of an affair that has been revealed, I will often tell them this. Today in the West, most of us are going to have two or three relationships or marriages. And some of us are going to do it with the same person. Your first marriage is over. Would you like to create a second one together? Thank you.
It's not over until it's over. So basically when she says that your first marriage is over, it is stepping away from who you have been. It doesn't mean that you guys are getting divorced. It doesn't mean that. It just means that you are stepping away from the you you used to be and stepping into a new you. So it's like a house burning down. And now you have an opportunity to rebuild a house or to rebuild the house. And it's now your chance to either build exactly the same as the old one or to build something new and something vibrant that you can actually enjoy in this new section of who you are. All right.
What if I told you that you could overcome anything? But there isn't a circumstance or situation known to man that you cannot overcome. That you are indeed unbreakable. Did you believe me? And more importantly than me telling you, if you told yourself those things, would you believe you? I want to talk to you about a critical element of happiness, success, and overcoming obstacles. Resilience, and how it's built through some of the most painful moments. I'm not sure what the ideal route to a TED Talk is, but I'm guessing that my journey isn't it. I was born and raised in Oakland, California, coming of age in the 1980s, and it's nearly 20% unemployment rate for blacks, systemic housing segregation and discrimination, education inequities, high poverty and murder rates, and the dawn of the crack epidemic and its partner, the war on drugs, that made historical criminal justice inequities even worse. Against that backdrop, I also came of age with a mother who would become an addict and a father who, though his listed occupation on my birth certificate says custodian, he was also a pimp. Despite their flaws and doing the best that they could in a situation that exploited the worst of themselves, I knew that my parents loved me to pieces, and I loved them to pieces. My mom had custody of me as we moved and settled into Acorn Housing Projects in West Oakland. It's during a 3-year period between age 7 and 10 years old that some of the most traumatic yet vivid moments of my childhood would play out as my mother's disease of addiction took root. When I close my eyes, I see them all just as clearly today as they happened decades ago. By the time I discovered my mother's boyfriend, eyes wide open, laying on the floor of a drug overdose. A discovery that initially paralyzed me in fear, much in the same way that his body lay motionless at my feet as he blankly stared at the ceiling. Like the day my mother sat me down on my bed to read me a handwritten letter that my dad had written and sent me in the mail. It would be the first time I'd ever heard the five-syllable word incarcerated and learned what it meant. Like the day my grandmother, who took over raising me when we were evicted out of the projects due to my mother's addiction, received a call to inform me that my father, after being jumped in a prison fight, was brain dead. He would die later that night before I ever saw him again alive. Like the times I would later visit my own mother in jail, a hazy plexiglass window separating us physically and emotionally, while also serving to remind me of the fate that my father met in those very walls. I felt the pain, the sadness, the shame, the solitude, the adjectives that as a preteen meet the clinical definitions of depression. Yet when I opened my eyes, the worst of life couldn't take out the best of me. Because I'm still standing here in front of you. Despite being truly disadvantaged, I stand here in front of you having overcome all those things and more. I would emerge as the first in my family to graduate college, earning undergraduate and master's business degrees. Then on to a nearly two-decade corporate career before starting my own venture. I've been from the projects to exploring a couple dozen countries across the world. From poverty to being the furthest from broke and broken that I've ever been. From tragedy to triumph. I have overcome, and even already, I have succeeded. I could entertain and engross you in a fascinating story of how, but that's not nearly as important as a different question. Why? Why do I and others still succeed and flourish despite immense pain and trauma? Those people and myself, they aren't just strong or thick-skinned or good at compartmentalizing. What they are is resilient. You see, change, it's a constant in life. Nothing gives us immunity from it. Resilience is the capacity to adapt to negative change and recover from it as quickly as possible. Now, note that I said negative change, as you typically don't need any help in coping with positive change. Right? You get the job that you interviewed for and it comes with a 30% pay increase. Or you find out class is canceled the day that you have an exam that you haven't prepared for. Oh, it's a bunch of A students in here, right? It's just me. Okay. Well, those are really good things. And so you don't need any help or strategies on how to cope with the good fortune. It's the negative things, the hurtful things, the bad things in life, where our level of resilience matters. How we process, respond to, and act will have huge implications on where the story goes from there. Whether we succumb to it or we surmount it. But understand, to exercise resilience, some change in circumstances must happen, must have happened. Some change in circumstances must have happened. The idea is to understand your belief system. Your beliefs impact your feelings. Your feelings impact how you think about things, and your thoughts ultimately impact how you act and respond. I discovered this truth not through some bolt from the clouds, some specific aha moment, but from going through and escaping my own hell as a youngster. There were some excruciatingly painful, gut-wrenching days. Days where I didn't even know how I was going to move forward, and the only thing that I could cling to was an irrational hope. A belief that tomorrow would be better than today, sometimes without even really truly believing it myself. But there I was, trying to make each moment better than the next. Today's better than tomorrow, without sacrificing my future for today's pain. Even at a young age, and despite not knowing what scholars and researchers were already confirming, I was laying the foundation of resilience by using the most important resource available to me, my mind. I wish I could say that the bad luck truck stop dropping boxes of trauma off in my doorstep when I was a kid, but life doesn't adhere to any delivery windows. Change comes whenever it comes, and for as long as we all live. After my childhood, I'd go on to experience the death of family and friends, job loss, financial issues, health crisis, all the things that life has a tendency to throw at us. To show you how much of a comedian God is, he gave me a breakup, heartbreak, and distraction to start this very week as I was preparing to talk to you about resilience. Like, really? Now? So what does trauma teach us about resilience? Sometimes we need to tell ourselves what to think when our mind starts telling us things that we don't need to hear. That you can and will overcome and succeed. And not just in spite of, but precisely because of. That with the proper perspective and a positive attitude, we have power. That life is easier when you're prepared. And just because you can't plan for everything, doesn't mean you can't be ready for something. That perspective sometimes requires partnership and perseverance. And understand, sometimes it gets hard and it's tough and it's painful. You get tired, you get weak, and when you don't know how to keep going, sometimes all the strength you need, it's the strength to ask others for help. That it's okay to acknowledge that I was a victim, but refuse to own being a victim. You get that subtle distinction, that difference between past and present tense? That gives us power. Power to change the way we think, power to change our circumstances, and ultimately power to overcome. Because of my faith, I've long been a believer that everything happens for a reason. Some reasons are immediately available to you, others take time to reveal themselves. As I was piecing together my talk, one of the central questions I kept coming back to was, who am I talking to? I ultimately realized that I was talking to the adolescent me, the college me, the professional me, even the future me with life adversity yet to be encountered. The varying versions of me is who I was telling, you are indeed unbreakable, that you can overcome anything. But if you happen to find a little something in your eavesdropping to help you through whatever adversity you face, then I was talking to the adolescent you, the college you, the corporate you, the professional you, the future you, too. And more than anything, I thank you for giving my trauma a purpose. Thank you.
Yo, when we talk about trauma, ladies and gentlemen, we always think that it comes from, oh my goodness, such dramatic bad things like, whoa, 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 shima shakele ketane, whoa, 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 whoa. Hey. But sometimes, right, it is what people say, what people do, and how people react and how they handle you that might just traumatize you. Imagine being betrayed by a friend that you have deemed so close to you, so everything in your life, and here you are, this person is like, no. I'm just going to throw this person under the bus, and that is going to be our reality. So, ladies and gentlemen, once upon a time, there was this gentleman. Sorry. Once upon a time, there was this gentleman, and his name was Paul. It's a true story, no? His name was Paul. And Paul in himself, he was a charming young man. They always are. Charming young man, good looking young man, and he basically grew up with his mom and his dad, and then his dad left at some point because his dad couldn't deal with his mother, what, doesn't want to be together anymore, and that was Paul's life. So Paul was, the last born of three children. So he was the baby in the house, and he was said to be extremely attractive. He was handsome, he was cute, he was funny, he was loving, he was also very, very smart, and even though they came from a difficult background in terms of finances, right? Somewhere, somehow, or shiri, Paul didn't struggle like that. He got a job, and then he got another job, and then all these two jobs were balancing, and he was just in high school at the time, and he was the captain of the football team, and he was a people person, and he was just nice, you know? And Paul went on now to go and eventually go to university. Now, when we talk about going to university, in small towns or stories such as this one, we always associate it to you coming from Kaanja to come in school at UNAM, you coming from Tinta Best to come in school at Valvicha, you coming from Lutheret to come in school at IUM here in Windhoek, you know? So he eventually went to the city to go and further on his studies, and he was doing business management at the time, and business management and corporate financing or something like that. So he was a numbers person, and he was a business kind of person, so he was business oriented. So in one summer, there was allegations that there were a few women that were pressing charges against this guy that was raping women, basically. So he just pulls up behind them when they are jogging or when they are doing things of that nature, like yoga or anything that, like, exercise on the outside. Now, there are certain spaces that you assume to be safe because you've lived there for years. You're like, I'm just walking down the street, man. Nothing has ever happened, and I don't think that it's going to just start happening now. So women were being violated. So it was like three women got raped and in the park after they were running. So after that, the police started patrolling, and the police started telling people, you know, putting the word out there that we might have a serial rapist on our hands, and it's not advice for you guys to not be walking in groups. You guys must be walking together, and so forth. Okay. So let's leave Paul. So there was this young lady, her name was Stacy. So Stacy was 17 at the time, and Stacy them came from, let's say, Walvis Bay. They came from Walvis Bay to Windhoek to come and play sports or something like that. They came to play sports, and then they were also having debates and stuff like that. And they were being hosted by the university, whatever university it is, by the university. This is a true story. It's just not a Namibian story. It's a true story, just not a Namibian story. And I was too, you know, too busy to remember all the things. California State University and, no, the idea is the moral of the story. So the girls were being hosted by the university, and they were basically being given accommodation and the facility to, they were being facilitated by the university. So the girls were here, but they were minors, right? They're like 17, 16, 15. And there was a girl named Stacy there, and she was 17, and she was the captain of the debate team. And then she was also the captain of the volleyball team, and she was very decorated. And that day, I don't know what Paul did, but he decided to go and pass by the foyer, the glass foyer, where people are doing all these activities. And that's when he eyed her, and he saw her, and he's like, oh, I like her, but she's a baby. At the time, he was 23 and she was 17. So he's like, ooh, gap, mind gap, which I feel like age gap is like 7 years. Like, no. But, Paul wanted to talk to her anyway. So he went up to her, and, people say that it looked like it was something written from a movie. It was like a script, and it was more of love at first sight shandies. And it's like, wow, everybody was so smitten. Like, wow. And apparently they looked good standing next to each other, which is weird. Okay, which is weird, but all right. So they started talking, and from there on, they started talking via the phone. And back in the day, it was more of the telephone, not cell phone things. It was the telephone. So Stacy had told her parents that, no, she met a guy, and he's very serious, and he's a nice person, and yes, she can see the age gap, but it's not a big deal for her, because he's willing to wait, and he's willing to be patient, and whatnot. But Stacy was like the oldest of three children in her household. So she was Mesheri, and she was deemed to be a very responsible, very loving, and very caring somebody. So in this, the parents didn't really mind her dating an older guy, as long as there was nothing funny going about it. And the rapes were still continuing, the rapes in Windhoek. They were still continuing. They're still continuing. And then eventually, one day, one of the survivors decided that, she can actually identify. She can identify the rapist. So they got a sketch artist in, and the sketch artist came in and started sketching and tried to compose a face and make of it something. And the picture was now released in the newspapers, right? And when it was released in the newspapers, there were friends of Paul that said that, man, but this guy resembles Paul so much. He looks just like Paul, you know? And one of the friends even decided that they are going to call the police and tell them that, no, this person looks like my friend Paul Bernardo, you know? That's his real name. Paul Bernardo. Now, this person looks like one of my close friends, Paul Bernardo. And then Paul was called in. He was called in to talk, most like, okay, so this sketch kind of looks like you. So what the dealio? Where have you been this day? And what were you doing this day? And he was being interrogated, or investigated rather. And, not investigated. He was just being interrogated. He was just being asked questions, and he answered them peacefully. He was very cooperative. He answered them peacefully. He answered every single question to the T, and basically he had alibis for every single day. And at the time, our DNA game was like Namibia's current DNA game, non-existent. But okay. So the DNA game at the time, it was not really advanced. And this is in America, eh? It was not really advanced so much. And also, the technology was just starting to pick up. So there were at least 120 DNA samples, né, from the rapes that have been happening. So the police opted to ask him to give them a sample, like, please give us a sample of your DNA. And Paul was more than willing. And everybody's like, yeah, that's not the ways of a guilty person. So Paul cooperated with the police fully, gave the DNA fully, and, you know, he just went about his life. And the police was like, I don't think it's that guy, because also he was not sweating, he was not nervous. It's like, So after that, somewhere, somehow, Paul was starting to feel a little weird and uncomfortable, especially considering the fact that it was one of his friends that called the police to tell the police that, oh, it looks like him. So he felt kind of betrayed. So that's why we're talking about betrayal trauma. You know, he felt kind of betrayed, like, bro, this whole time, that's what you think of me. Like, are there not specific things that you would think that, like, ah, no, Paul would never do this. So just because somebody looks like me, you would automatically think it's me. So he decided that, you know what, I'm going to move. And by then he had been dating Stacy for like 3 years at this point. And they've been going back and forth in their relationships. Their relationship, it was like a long distance relationship. So they had been going back and forth. So he decided that he's going to move to the coast. He's going to move to the coast and he's going to live with, Stacy's parents, Stacy's family. Which is not a big deal because the family actually liked him and loved him. He was a helpful somebody. He was not just like a couch potato kind of vibe. No, he was a helpful somebody. So even in that, the family welcomed him fully. And they also started noticing that when they argued, Paul got really, really angry, like really, really angry. And it never got physical, but it was like really, really angry. The type of angry that you're like, this type of anger that you're having, this rage that you're having. But then also it just so happened that when Paul moved, the rapes went away completely, like fully, completely. There was no more rapes there. So that was one of them. And in that said, Paul now proposed at some point and he proposed marriage. And so they were working, both of them, Stacy and Paul, they were working. Paul was most now a graduate, you know, and he was going for his master's. And, Stacy had just basically matriculated and then went to first year. So she was like a fresh year, a first year. And then she was also working at some diner or some hotel. And that's how they were saving up money to buy their own house, and they were saving up money for the wedding. So now in Paul's childhood, he was known for a couple of things around the people that have known him ever since he was a child. He was known to be a peeping Tom. So a peeping Tom is a dude that stands by the window and watches you undress. Like when you come from work, they stand at the window and then they watch you undress. That's a peeping Tom. So in his history, there is those kinds of violations and those kinds of complaints. But nothing more than that. And it didn't progress to anything, that peeping Tom. Eventually he just stopped one day and then he was over it better or something like that. So Stacy and Paul were now, you know, getting into adulthood, like, or deeper commitment. And they were now arranging for their marriage. So Paul proposed somewhere in February and they were scheduled to get married in November. So while they were living there, one day when Stacy's parents were not there, and it was just the kids, right? Don't forget that Stacy is an older sibling, né? So everybody is younger than her. They said that apparently Stacy and Paul were having an argument, and then Paul turned around and hit her. Like, but hit her bad, bad, bad. Like, so bad that she had to go to the hospital. And they asked, you know, do you want to press charges? And she went vandalinious on us and said, no, that's my baby. I'm not going to do that. That's my baby, you know? And that was now the beginning of physical abuse in their relationship, because now every single time that he gets angry or something, apparently there's just no self-control. There's no self-discipline. Apparently it must just be korut, 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 korut. So she was getting beatings, and it was, beatings of, when the parents intervened, Paul would spin a whole different story to make the parents kind of just that uncomfortable, that your child is the wrong one kind of thing. And I know that we are thinking that, yeah, no matter how wrong my child is, right, I'm not going to be letting somebody just be beating my child like that. If she's so wrong, leave her. But in those times, people were very desperate for marriage, or people thought that you can work out anything. And also they didn't know what a narcissist is. They didn't know all these terms. They didn't know trauma. They didn't know betrayal trauma. They didn't know all of this. So somewhere around September, the parents go to bed, and Paul and Stacy and Stacy's younger sister, they are downstairs, and they're basically having a good time, right? They're having a good time, and in this good time, Paul has started now that peeping Tom behavior that he had in his kindergarten or younger years, right? He started doing it now to Stacy's younger sister. She was like, I think 14 or something. He used to start watching her, like open the door and just go and watch her a little bit, or go to the window when she's dressing, or go to the bathroom when she's dressing, just to watch her and stuff like that. So he started watching her. So he started eyeing her like a predator. Not like in the, what is she doing? No, there's no that. It was basically just trying to get a glimpse of the good, good. And so this night, Paul whispers to Stacy and says that, I'm just so sad. I'm just so sad. Just imagine like this conversation happening in whisper. I'm so sad. I feel like there's this one thing you can never offer me in my life. And it just makes me so sad. And now Stacy is most now drunk also, like in consent. Like, what is it that I can't offer you? And then he says, your virginity. Ow. Stacy's like, grr, grr, grr. Because it so happens that when Paul got there, she was already deflowered by someone else. So that's now apparently his premise of sadness in his life. And he just wish it could just go away. And he just wish it was better. And he started going with it, you know. After that night, they chilled. They did their shots. The younger sister was not drinking. She was basically just enjoying their company. And also she loved Paul so much. This younger sister loved Paul so much. It was like her big brother. It was like, oh, Biggie. Biggie. And so she enjoyed spending time with them as a couple. She's like, oh, you guys are so perfect, you know? So Paul started now, harassing, or is it harassing, or, you know, instigating, putting pressure there by Madame Kuchaya. I think that maybe you should offer me your sister's virginity. Stacy's like, what? I can't offer you my sister's virginity. It's not my body, you know? And he gets angry and he throws a tantrum, and it's silent treatment. Like, yeah, I just knew that you never loved me, and that kind of manipulation. Like, because that's twisted, man. Like, what? No, it's not my body. And even if it was my body, I cannot just, it's my sister, you know? So apparently Stacy decides that she's going to cave in. And at this point, Stacy was not working at the hotel anymore. She was working at the vet. And you know, at the vet's office, they have most tranquilizers for the animals. So Stacy planned the whole thing, which I know, when people go to sleep one day, we're going to invite her, and then we are going to tell her like, no, take your first drinks with us so that you don't go and do stupid things out there in the world. And then they are going to drag her, and then he's going to do what he wants to do, right? Okay. So she gets a tranquilizer, And she gets a tranquilizer and she puts it in her younger sister's drink. And she went and put it in her sister's drink and her sister started drinking, and it wasn't even like 10 minutes, like 5 minutes into that drink, the sister was knocked out cold. And then I don't know why they had to go and do this, because the person was most now knocked out, right? They still got that, I don't know, that okanastuke. You know, in movies how they have the napkin that they hold over people's nose and then the person passes out. So they took that thing as well. And then on top of her being tranquilized, right? They put that on top of her mouth while Paul did his things. So Paul was doing his things and then Stacy was holding her sister down with a cloth. And I don't know what kind of twisted in the betrayal name is that. I don't know what that is, but hellfire guys, like, how? Oh no, like, you're holding her down, like, do you know what you guys are doing here? I know. So at some point, right, she notices that her sister is not breathing anymore, and they notice that basically, like, she's unconscious now. Like, it's not even the type of knocked out. It's like unconscious, dying kind of unconscious, right? And she was foaming at the mouth and something like that. And they decide now that no, they are going to dress her up. And then after dressing her up, they are going to call the police. And at the time, everything was really just a nightmare. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening, Tate King.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine, man.
What
is happening?
What is happening where, my dear? We're talking about betrayal trauma.
Oh, this betrayal is not working.
The app is not working.
Oh, I keep trying.
You're outside.
Until I say, let me guess, Paul.
Nah, you are outside. Yeah. My goodness.
So you are talking about betrayal.
Yeah, betrayal syndrome. Yeah. When you have been betrayed and it was just hectic. Have you ever been betrayed?
This one is part of life.
I don't know. Is it part of life?
Yeah. That's in my meaning of life, if you ask me to define.
Now, tell us about a time that you were betrayed.
Can I remember? The problem with me, I hardly take things personal. Like, I think, yeah, maybe I was betrayed. I can't remember.
You don't remember?
But all I know how it feels to be betrayed. I think I've been betrayed. And
how does it feel?
I just cannot recall one specific occasion. But I know. I think I've been betrayed.
Have you betrayed anybody? I don't know if it's part of life or not. That's why I'm asking you.
How can you go to grave without being betrayed or betraying someone? Yeah, but betrayal in which way now?
Any betrayal?
No. I don't think I ever betrayed anyone. Because for me, betrayal is part of stealing, part of being cruel.
So
I don't go with that.
Because you were nice, you're a nice guy.
Not really nice, but it's part of my standard. So that's not how I choose to live life, because with betrayal comes with there will be consequences.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be from the person you are betraying.
But you can't even remember who betrayed you, and you can't remember who you betrayed. Like, I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't know.
I didn't betray anyone, man. I don't know. I don't know if that was betrayal. If I betrayed that guy, no, I don't know.
Because
I told him to ask something. He didn't know the name of it. But I told him, no, just say this in English, record this. And you know, English was a problem. That guy, he did not come to school, man. So the next day when he came, everybody was having those parcels. Mathematic person. So him, when it was mathematic time.
Yeah.
Everybody is going in the bed. Now he's wondering what's happening. And it was his first time to see such a thing.
Oh my God.
I said, yeah, man, this one is a coffer. You know that kind of thing is a written coffer on top.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, this one is a coffer. Just ask. Just say, miss, I don't have a coffer. I stand up. He stood up, and then the teacher said, hey, what's happening? I don't have a coffer.
Mm-hmm.
The whole class looked at him, what is he talking about? And I said, he didn't this. Everybody started laughing. I don't know if I betrayed him like that, but yeah.
You're pretty close.
But for me, I've been betrayed. There are guys that will tell you, man, borrow me this, I'll give it to you on Friday or end of the month. End of the month comes, the man is nowhere to be found. Just dodging. So, I realized, you know what, you cannot be chasing the person. So, if they were honest, they will come back. Only to find out that, no, man, this is how this guy operates. He will do this to me. The next time, he will do it to someone else. So it's a way of income. Some people just do that. Or just laugh. They will tell you they are borrowing, but there's nothing like borrowing.
Why don't people just say, give me?
So you want to make sure that you give. If you say give me, there's a chance of you saying no. So you have to make sure it leaves you with confidence that, you know what, I will get this back. And sometimes what he will do, there are times that he will borrow from me.
Yeah.
For example, he'll borrow from me, and when it's end of the month, then he will come to you, borrow from you. What he's borrowing from you
is what he owes the other person?
No, he's coming to pay half to me. Just like that. And before you know, this person is addicted in that.
To borrowing.
When such people get a job also, they go in that, now you can go to a cash loan. Then they will keep it running. Nobody's chasing them, but they are running away. They don't answer calls. They will tell you they don't like private numbers because they have other people's things. So, man, I cannot recall any painful betrayal done to me or maybe. I did not betray anyone.
Okay.
God knows.
I also don't think me, I'm a betrayer, man.
Yeah.
I think I'm a nice, chilled lady.
But what was your focus when, what is your focus when you are talking about betrayal?
We are talking about betrayal syndrome or betrayal trauma. So betrayal syndrome, it generally refers to the cluster of symptoms and psychological distress, often called post-betrayal syndrome or betrayal trauma, that can result from being violated or being betrayed by a person or an institution that you belong, that you depended on.
I can tell you a story of
Let me give you an example, ne, of betrayal syndrome.
Yeah.
Betrayal syndrome is what you go through after the Ministry of Health leaks your HIV status with your name, your ID number, your residential address and everything. Because you trusted, no, because you trusted them.
Yeah, I've become,
mm-hmm.
I've just become like Emmanuel.
Hey.
The other Emmanuel.
Which one, the one of, which
and
one is that?
And the other meme, who was that meme that was always in that, Truth Life?
Hmm?
Yeah, that one, I understand. There was this guy. He had a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything nice.
Yeah.
Planning to...
To get married.
To get married.
They always plan to get married, those ones.
And you know, a guy had a good job.
Mm.
And he was... No, man. He was shining. He was doing what men need to do.
Mm.
Taking care of things, doing that, going extra mile.
Mm-hmm.
Just to, you know, lo and behold, that girl was just saving other people behind his back.
Many people or what?
Many people.
How many is many?
It doesn't matter. Because whatever he found out, there are always, there might be people that he never found out, but he found out something.
Mm.
And the guy, he was broke to a point of, he looked at himself as nothing.
Mm.
He lost hope.
Oh.
Up to today.
Yes.
That guy even lost his job, man.
Yeah.
And so what he went through, but he decided he's not going to kill himself, he's not going to kill anyone, but he made up his mind that he will never come closer to a woman.
Mm.
He doesn't want anything to do with a woman. And that guy today, telling you, he doesn't care. Whatever girl he sees, he's scared. He doesn't want anything to do with, ladies.
Mm, the opposite gender.
Yeah. He can talk with them, he can drink, but he does not want anything like a relationship. Nothing.
Mm.
Because of how he was betrayed.
Mm.
So that is now, I think, what you are talking about.
Yes, that one also. But why? Yeah. But why do men find it difficult to get over it?
Don't say men.
Hey, so if you get home today and your wife is just busy with Mshinda,
yeah, I'm with Boko Haram, my friend.
Oh, you see those things. You see those things. Why? Why? That's what I'm talking about, huh? That's what I'm talking about. Hey, like, so you'll just be okay with it. You'll just go on with your life, you know?
Okay, you know what? The problem is, most of men are emotionally weak.
Oof.
And they do not know how to strengthen their emotions. They don't know how to overcome their emotions. That's why you find, you find this guy, he's having a girlfriend, and then he have other girls outside.
Yeah.
And then those girls outside town,
mm-hmm.
he do not want them to be with other men. Mm-hmm. And this one that is having in town,
mm-hmm.
he does not want to hear anything
mm-hmm.
that this girl went with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And if he found out that one of these girls
mm-hmm.
have someone else,
mm-hmm.
that's how you see how stupid people can be.
Mm-hmm.
You want to overreact, you want to do whatever they want to do. That's why we see a lot of killing
mm-hmm.
in our nation. It's because of people who are emotionally weak.
Mm-hmm.
They do not know how to control their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can put yourself in the other person's shoe,
mm-hmm.
I'm not saying people must go around and have other people. But I'm saying,
mm-hmm.
put yourself in the shoes of that person that you see outside town.
Yeah.
And you only go there twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you do not want to see that person with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's people, you know, like for me, life, there's no luck in life.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no unluck for me.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's all about opportunity and preparation. Prepare your mind.
Hold the line, please. Hold the line, Tate George.
If you are set to save, You Save is a shop to be this month end. When last did you only pay 94.99 for 5 kilos of Marathon white sugar, or $116.99 for Champion Super Maize meal, or just 64.99 for 3 kilos of Grande pasta, and $27.99 for Rama Original 70% fat spray? You Save, your low budget grocery store where good food costs less.
Hey, yes, Tate King.
You know what?
Mm-hmm.
One thing I like to do is to arm myself with information.
Yeah.
Even at a point where I don't need it.
As long as you have it.
Yeah.
Mm.
So if I come to your workplace,
mm-hmm.
in your office, and then you ask me, hey, when you were in my office, what did you read there? If there are written things there, I will tell you that I read this, you know. Some people will be looking in their phone. But for me, I will decide, you know what, it's my phone, I can always have it.
Yeah, let I can read it. Later.
Yeah, let me check what's new here.
Mm.
I can pick up one or two things that were not in my vocabulary or were not in part of me. And I can mm-hmm. learn them. So, people, if you are prepared,
mm.
prepare yourself. Even if you are not going to war,
mm.
just be prepared. Know how to fight.
Mm.
If you happen to be in a war, you don't need much training.
Mm.
You are already in the way, you know?
Mm.
So if you equip yourself, you prepare yourself, you make room for disappointment.
Mm.
Even if you are not going to be disappointed, make room.
For disappointment.
For disappointment. It's like you have a visitor's room in your house.
Mm.
But sometimes a year passes by without having a visitor.
Then we must just keep the rumors.
Yeah, the room must just be there, very clean. In case you have a visitor, the visitor's room is clean, you know. You have mm-hmm. nothing to worry about. So, prepare yourself. Make room for disappointment.
Sure.
Make room for betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, I'm not saying be thinking about betrayal constantly. If you think about that, mm-hmm. you are more like inviting it. So, just decide if this happens, hey, I move on with life. You think of options. Like, if this happens, I'll do this, I'll do that, you know?
Mm.
And when it happens to you, you say, hey, man, I'm a man of my word, you know? I think I'll do this. Let me just do the thing.
Mm.
It was easy to say 5 years ago.
Mm.
that day, I just had to do it. Because 5 years ago, I think my mind was on the right track. So, whatever I'm going to feel now, let me overcome my feelings. Because feelings changes. So, how you feel at that time, at the moment you are betrayed or disappointed, will not be the same after a few days.
Yeah.
So, you don't make decisions when you are
angry.
When you are not feeling well. You know?
When you're not feeling well.
When you are angry, when you feel betrayed, when you feel like you are nothing, hey, that one is just part of life. You know, it comes and goes. It's like temperature. Yeah, but the problem is, it comes when you think, yeah, this one is just one and only. She will never disappoint me. He will never disappoint me. When you are going to find out, you are going to do things that you never thought you are going to do. Because you never make room for frustration. You always say, even the Bible says, trust in your name. If you put your trust in your name, it's like you put yourself in a snake, Katenga. We one way
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, we can have that level of trust, but we cannot completely to say 100%. My wife, I can always trust my wife. That's her story. If she waves, that's her story. My life continues. The problem is when stupid guys, they want to cry. I cannot live without you.
Why can't you live without me? Why? Why can't you live without me? You've been alive for so long. What is wrong with you?
And if you find that guy that says he cannot live without you, problem. Just know that there's a problem there. Your life could be in danger. If anything happens.
It's him.
Because now, it's all about him. That's all I can say, man.
Okay.
People need to make room for certain things in life. I go through many things, man.
You don't even remember if anybody betrayed you.
Yeah, that's why I want to tell you. There are many things I went through in life. But I cannot recall, who so and so did this to me. Because I don't take things personal. I don't allow such things to shape me. I go through such things. It's like I go through water. I cannot remember when last, the time I took a shower. And I came out shivering to the point where I did not go where I wanted to go.
So there's this guy in the coast. Not in the coast, in Usakos, man. So this guy was found doing criminal activities by a police officer. Right? And then the police officer is like, put down your gun now. I need to arrest you. Put down your gun now. Then the guy is like, no, you must put down your gun or else I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to kill myself if you don't put down your gun, you. Police officer, put down your gun. Otherwise, I'll kill myself. Police officer puts down his gun. Police officer gets shot and killed. Then the guy runs away to, I think it was to Sokop or to Valfes Bay.
Oh, no more killing himself.
He did. That's the thing now, like. You see, the way these criminals will betray our trust. They will betray our trust, these criminals. Okay. And then the guy goes to the coast and then he's found by law enforcement again because he's on the run most now. And people are alert, the law enforcement is alert of his things. So the police officer gets there, and then it's gunfight again. Yeah, take out your gun, take out your gun. Let's fight and see. Now, the guy is like, yeah, if you don't put down your gun, I'll kill myself.
Okay.
I'm telling you, same trick, huh? This guy was like, yeah. The guy shot him, he's dead. The guy shot him, he's dead.
Yeah, I know, man.
Oh, that's now betrayal. Because you were trying to do, you know, like the thing that you guys are trained to do at work, you know, which are de-escalate the situation. De-escalate the situation and, you know, make it better, that, make it what. Oh.
That job, trusting a stranger with a gun. Not just a
whole stranger with a gun. Ay.
And he's talking about killing
himself.
If I'm going to put down my gun, I have to make sure I shoot off one of your hands.
Oh, like, or your leg or something, bruh. Like, no.
Oh, yeah, you cannot run. I will not kill you, but I will shoot you. No. Yeah, that's now betrayal. A lot of people, the reason why people are not happy in life is because of betrayal. In business, there is betrayal. There are people that are crying because they have been betrayed. And there are people who cannot trust when you want to do business with them.
Yeah.
They are telling you like, I have learned. We can't do this. Because first we have to do this and this. They have to make sure they are on a safe side.
Yeah.
Because they have learned from betrayal. And you also don't wait to be betrayed. You learn from those that have been betrayed. Yeah, so.
You don't have to wait to be the one that's betrayed. You can just also just.
Yeah, learn from others. And that's why you see, a lot of people don't have peace.
They want problems always.
Some people don't want people.
Yeah.
Because when they look at people, they see another suspect.
Yeah, but that's where it comes from. Nobody is born like that. That's what I'm talking about. That's where it comes from. Nobody is born like that, my friend.
Yeah,
nobody is born like that. It's just you people that just keep betraying us until we trust no one at all in our lives. You're like, no.
Now, everybody in town is a suspect.
Yeah.
when you go to the village, then it's like, now you see the real people. Yeah, these are people. But when you come to town, everybody in town is a suspect. Yeah. Trust nobody in town.
Trust nobody. Not in town.
No, some people, they feel like that when they're in town. And when they go to the village, they feel a bit relief. They feel, yeah, this is a normal human being. Yeah, so a lot of people are hanging themselves, taking their lives because they have been betrayed. Some people, you know, sometimes there are things that excite us. You are excited and you think, yeah, man, I'll do. But the other person is also looking for their income from anybody who is not using their minds well.
Yeah.
And the moment you are going to realize, you are lost. You have lost already. And now when you think about your children, you think about your wife, you come home, you take your life, you leave no notice. And people are wondering, what happened? We never thought of this. Yeah, something went wrong in town. Okay, mama.
All right, Tati King, bye. Don't betray anybody, okay?
Not yet.
Bye.
But I don't plan to.
All right. Okay. Ciao. Alrighty, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As we emerge in our conversation around betrayal, we're just talking about betrayal, betrayal syndrome, and why there are people out there in the world that just don't trust anybody. Beloved, it is because they have been so betrayed in their lives, ne? That it's like, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. Would I not be doing myself an injustice here if no, guys. It's an injustice if I'm trusting people again after I know what people are capable of. Whoa, 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 whoa. And that's why people are out here not trusting anybody because, I know I was supposed to trust the people so that the people can hurt us a little bit more, a little bit deeper, a little bit harder. You're like, yay, 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 yay. Oh, ladies and gentlemen. So today is, it's chilled. It's cool and calm, so super salam. Let's quickly take a break.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM now.
Onda kalahandu yako parateza morwe data. Paife ohandimo kuyadi. Nondaka ne data no shoyo o tungaraka mahupi. O netwe kaimwe o kufutarumwe o kuinyengarumwe o kujapandali fio papa ndauka. Onda pumga o netwe kaoyo hai dira dira ya fange. Omafikwamwe ohandi streaming. Omafikwamwe ohandi popi. Omafikwamwe ohandi ningaishe poshika poshimwe. Pamwe na parateza, oenda holora, ameha ishipangere, osho paumwene. Dira dira omakwata fanoni data, momkaro wili, mwana parika okutuma koutumaraka, okustreaminga, no kudenga pamwe na parates. Konga, parates, Namibia.
Always, always prepare, parates.
When I was a child, I remember playing outside and out of my parents' sight for hours. The neighbor's kids, my little brother, and I, we would climb trees in the woods, build hideouts, wade in the river, meet new friends. And only much later did it strike me how much trust this must have required on my parents' side. Trust in the people we would meet, trust in the older kids, but also trust in me. And I often wondered whether and how the trust possibly influenced me. And then I grew up, I became a cognitive psychologist, and now I investigate the processes that enable us humans to coordinate and cooperate with one another. And again, I look at trust, and I notice that trust really is a key component in our social lives. And I want to share insights with you, insights from psychology, social neuroscience, and behavioral economics, to back up my three favorite points about trust. And that is that trust can be difficult. Trust is dynamic. And most of all, trust is indispensable. Especially when we don't know people well or when we meet strangers for the first time, deciding whom to trust really can be a challenge. Nonetheless, we humans make this decision often within a few hundred milliseconds. But what do we base this important decision on? Well, one cue we use to decide whether or not to trust somebody is their faces, their facial features. Let me show you two examples. Whom of these two guys would you rather trust? Who chooses the left one? Raise your hand. Who chooses Mr. Right, the right one? A few, yeah. Your vote nicely reflects findings from psychology showing that people largely tend to agree on who does and who doesn't look trustworthy. And it's areas around the eyes, areas around the mouth that are relevant here. But is the guy on the left really more trustworthy? No. So far, there is no concluding evidence that people with trustworthy faces also behave in a more trustworthy manner. What else do we use? Well, when we meet people for the first time, we look for signals of authority, of competence. We tend to listen to and comply much more with people who are, for instance, dressed like this than people who are dressed like this. And you are all probably familiar with the famous Milgram experiments that were carried out in the 60s. In these experiments, normal people, people like you and I, were invited to a laboratory. And they were asked to punish students for not remembering words correctly. And punishment had to be administered by means of electric shocks. Now, of course, in reality, the students didn't really receive these shocks, but participants certainly believed so. Now, a surprising number of people like you and I, punished these poor students by administering lethal, deadly electric stimulation. And that is the critical point. They did so especially when the instructor, the one who instructed them to punish students, showed these tokens of authority and competence like a white lab coat. And I think this shows that trusting others merely on the basis of whether they seem competent or whether they seem to have authority can really have devastating consequences. Also, when we meet others for the first time, we tend to listen a lot to what others have to say about them, their reputation. And in fact, prior information we have about somebody else can have such a strong influence on our expectations that we entirely ignore how this person really behaves. So we ignore somebody's trustworthy behavior towards us when we already expect him or her to be untrustworthy. And these examples, I think, show that these signals of trustworthiness, how somebody's face looks, somebody's clothes, somebody's reputation, these signals of trustworthiness, they aren't so trustworthy themselves. And this makes deciding whom to trust difficult, because we have to put an effort into not trusting those who might not be as trustworthy as they look. And equally important, we have to make an effort to not deprive those of our trust who deserve it, but might not quite look like it. So we shouldn't judge strangers too quickly. That was all about situations in which we don't know others well. But even after we started an interaction, we start a relationship with somebody, trust isn't something we can just switch on. It is an inherently ongoing, interactive, and dynamic process. Now, psychologists and behavioral economists have studied trust for many decades, and they have used very simple paradigms in which trust is operationalized, is measured as an investment of time, of effort, or of money. And I show you one very simple paradigm. In this paradigm, in this task, you have two people, person A and person B. Let's call them Alice and Bella. They don't know each other. They are merely connected via an internet platform. They might see each other's picture. And they enter a formalized, a very simple interaction in which one of them, Alice, has a certain amount of money. Say Alice has 100 euros, and she can now choose how much she wants to invest in Bella. Say she chooses 60 euros. And now comes a critical part of this paradigm. This amount is then tripled. So Bella receives three times the amount that Alice has entrusted her with. And now it's Bella's turn. Bella can decide how much she wants to give back to reciprocate to Alice. If she chooses 90 euros, then Bella is left with 90 euros. Alice has 130 euros. That means that if Alice trusts and Bella reciprocates, both of them end up with more than they had before. Both of them benefit. And especially when we have this interaction continue for several rounds, this allows us to really look at the development, the dynamics of trust and of trust-based relationships. And this has yielded really interesting findings. For instance, in some people, in some groups, trust declines quickly. Cooperation breaks down. Nobody wins. Everybody's unhappy. By contrast, in other groups, other people manage to establish stable, functioning, mutually beneficial relationships. Everybody wins and everybody's happy. What's the difference? What do those who succeed do differently? Well, One thing that those who manage to establish long-term trust-based relationships do differently is they forgive. I think in most relationships there is a point where the other person does not behave the way we expected her to. For instance, Alice might be a bit disappointed because Bella didn't reciprocate as much as Alice expected her to. This can be a misunderstanding, it can be teasing, it can be an active breach of trust. In order for the cooperation to not break down, Alice needs to do something. Alice needs to overcome her uncertainty, even her anger, and give Bella a second chance. She needs to trust in, invest in Bella again. Maybe not 5 times or 6 times, but certainly once or twice. And that is, in fact, what the groups who manage to establish relationships that are mutually beneficial do differently. On the side of the other person, Bella, there might be situations when Bella notices Alice doesn't seem to trust me that much anymore. Alice doesn't invest that much in me anymore. There's also something that Bella can do. Bella can actively repair the relationship by coaxing Alice back into trusting her. And she can do that. She can convince Alice to trust her again by reciprocating especially much for a few rounds. So there is forgiving. There is coaxing others back into trusting us. And how do we do that? And there is a cognitive skill that is really crucial for these behaviors. And that is perspective taking or theory of mind. We need to take the perspective of the other, put ourselves in the shoes of the other. So we need to think about what the other wants, feels, plans, believes, or knows. We can only forgive others if we think about that, well, maybe there might be different reasons why the other behaved the way she did. Also, for coaxing others back into trusting us, we need to consider, well, yeah, maybe the other has lost trust in us. And not surprisingly, do neuroscientific findings show that brain areas that are involved in the process of taking others' perspective are also really important during trust-based interactions. So taken together, trust is not something we can just switch on. Trust is an inherently dynamic process. And saying I trust you or trust me is not the end of the story. It is really only the beginning. So far, it probably sounds to you as if trust is a pretty effortful business. We need to overcome these untrustworthy signals of trustworthiness that I talked about in the beginning. We need to think about what others are thinking about, and sounds all quite strenuous. But, and that is the last point, it is really necessary. Trust is indispensable. And trust is not really something that is just nice to have. It's not the cherry on the pie. I think that trust is the salt in our social supper, really. And if you think for a moment about these very simple interactions I just showed you, but also if you think about the interactions you have and the relationships you enter, then it becomes evident that without an initial leap of faith, without trust, cooperations, interactions, trust-based relationships could never be established. And a very touching example from the animal kingdom involves vampire bats. These little creatures need to feed every night or every second night at the latest, otherwise they starve. However, every night up to 30% of them don't catch food. And that would be quite tragic. Didn't they have specific mutual friendships with other bats in which food is shared? So if one bat doesn't catch anything, she can go to her friend and the friend regurgitates blood. That is pretty gross, but that is a lifesaver. And this favor is later reciprocated when the other bat did not catch anything. Critical point is that without an initial leap of faith, without an initial incident of one bat sharing with the other, this life-saving reciprocal interaction or relationship could never have been established. So we need trust to establish relationships. What else? Another benefit of trust is that we need trust to recognize signs of distrust. That sounds funny in the beginning. It seems, though, and that is what psychological research suggests, that people who tend to trust others less, and that is symbolized by the woman in the picture who doesn't expect anything good to come from the guy in his flowers, people who tend to expect the worst from others are also less capable of recognizing when others are hurt or huffed. they don't recognize signs of distrust. And as a consequence, they're less capable, less willing to repair relationships, to coax others back into trusting them. And as a consequence of that, their cooperations really break down more quickly. So, nice example of a self-fulfilling prophecy. As odd as it sounds, we need to trust. We need to be trustful to recognize distrust and then to repair relationships. And the final point is as simple as it is nice. We genuinely enjoy being trusted. When other people place trust in us, this makes us feel good. It makes us feel good about ourselves. And initial evidence from neuroscientific studies shows that our brains seem to inherently reward us for being trusted. And that's not all. Closing the circle, if you will, our brains not only reward us for being trusted, but also for being trustworthy. We genuinely enjoy behaving in a trustworthy manner. We don't want to breach others' trust. We want to reciprocate, to do right by others. So the strong preferences to be trusted and be trustworthy are deeply ingrained in us. So taken together, besides being a difficult business sometimes and besides being very dynamic, trust is really indispensable. We need trust to establish, to maintain, and to repair relationships. Trust empowers us, and we can empower others by trusting them. And this brings me back to my initial example of my parents and them letting me play outside and out of their sight. And maybe inspired by the vampire bats, they are dressed like vampires here. And that is quite a while ago. I think they allowed for a lot of good things to happen by trusting me to play out of their sight. Meeting new kids, I could learn that not everybody is as trustworthy or untrustworthy as they look. I could learn that maintaining relationships takes a lot of forgiving and being forgiven. And by trusting me, I think they taught me to trust others and trust myself. And that is a pretty great gift that I hope I can pass on to my children one day. Thank you.
Have you ever felt betrayed? If so, would you raise your hand? Look around. You're in good company. Thank you. And when you felt betrayed, have you been told to give it time to trust again or to forgive and move on? And if you've tried any of those things, have you felt better or bitter? If you have felt stuck in the pain of betrayal, I want you to know that there is a reason. What if I told you that how we've been thinking about healing from betrayal may fall short of addressing the most important loss, the loss of self? I'm Holly Kinley. I work in the field of psychology as a marriage and family therapist, and I'm the author of 4 books on betrayal. Many therapy clients feel stuck in betrayal and don't understand why. They're feeling confused, worthless, and powerless. And it's not their fault. Just as I once did, many therapists treat betrayal like grief. And as a result, my clients did not feel better. Of course, I too am no stranger to betrayal in my life. One of my life-changing experiences from college was in the fall of my sophomore year at the University of California at Santa Barbara. I needed to take a physical education requirement for a class, so I signed up for beginning sailing. Also, my dad was a sailor, and I thought this might make him proud. On the 4th weekend of class, the instructor informed us that we were going to be practicing outside the safety of the harbor. Away we went out into the vast ocean, 6 skiffs, 12 sailors, following behind our captain who motored out in front of us. Within a few minutes, a gust of wind all of a sudden came up and tossed our sailboat on its side. My partner and I were really struggling when suddenly another gust capsized it completely, emptying us both into the freezing ocean. When I came up, I looked around. The skiff was a few feet from me. My partner, the betrayer, was swimming away to another boat. I recalled the captain's words, "If you get into trouble, don't leave your partner, don't leave your boat." Off in the distance, I saw the captain motoring towards me. Good, he's coming to save me. As he got closer, he picked up his bullhorn and commanded, Holly, follow my orders. The winds are picking up. Right that boat. Was he nuts? I couldn't do this and not by myself, and this is not what I signed up for. I trusted in the rules of the game. I trusted my partner. With a tinge of anger in his voice, he again commanded, Holly, get going, right that boat. Over the next several minutes, I did everything I was told and mustered up every bit of strength that I had. I thrust myself over the backside of the boat like a seal sprawled across a rock. I reached down under, pulled in the small mainsail, and then slowly, using my body weight, made my way back across the boat from port to starboard side, when suddenly the boat flipped upright, tossing me back into the water. I thrust myself one more time inside the hull of the boat. I lay there catching my breath. Off in the distance, applause from 11 classmates, including the betrayer. Warm tears rolled down my face. I was proud of myself. A poised flute player who loved playing in concert band stepped into the burly role of a sailor and saved herself. My father would be proud. For anyone unfamiliar with sailing, to right yourself means to bring yourself upright, just like with a sailboat. Over the next several decades, I would face many betrayals in my life. But that experience of learning how to right myself would serve me well in the years to come. On Wednesday, April 8th, 2015, at 10 a.m., I called my 86-year-old father. It was our custom to chat several times a week. After a couple of rings, he picked up. Good morning, Dad. How you doing? Ah, fair to middling, he chuckled. Not so bad. Over the next several minutes, we talked about the weather and shared a few of our favorite TV shows. Although I knew he was struggling with some health issues, he never complained. We closed our conversation in the usual way. I'll call you Friday. I love you, Dad. I love you too, sweets. Over the next several minutes, I thought about and reflected upon how our relationship had healed over the past 30 years, from a daughter who was so angry with him to one who adored him. 2 days later, on Friday, April 10th, I called again at my usual time. No one answered. I tried several more times. Living over 800 miles away from my parents, I called one of my sisters who lived close by. The next several hours were filled with chaos, confusion, and catastrophe. After entering my parents' home, paramedics found their bodies barely alive. They were transported to a local hospital, my father in intensive care, my mother in serious but stable condition. Later that day, I would learn that on Wednesday afternoon, the day of my prior call, my parents planned out, carried out, but did not fully complete a dual suicide. A couple of days after the suicide attempts, I asked one of the nurses if she would place the phone next to my father's ear. She informed me he was dozing in and out of consciousness. I said, it doesn't matter. I need to speak to him. She kindly agreed to do so. Hi, Dad. It's me, Holly. I could hear his labored breathing. I love you, Dad. I love you so much. He mumbled something. In my mind, I could hear him say, I love you too, sweets. The next day, my father was moved home where he wanted to die. He passed away 3 days later under hospice care. My mother recovered and was moved to a nursing home. I'd like to acknowledge that talking about suicide is hard. It elicits a range of emotions, judgment, anger, compassion. Whatever might be coming up for you, I invite you to honor your feelings. immediately after the suicide attempts, my feelings were like fireworks shooting off inside. In sporadic moments of clarity, I asked myself, how am I going to get through this pain? It was not the pain of grief. It was the pain of betrayal. I knew what to do. I quieted my being and I turned inward as I began the hard work of righting my capsized mind and body. In the late 90s, my interest in the betrayal and recovery from it emerged in my work as a licensed marriage and family therapist. With well over 10,000 hours in session working with clients healing from abuse and trauma, I heard the words over and over again, I feel so betrayed. I knew how to address the trauma, but there was something that I was missing. And then in the mid-2000s, when the economy shifted downward, all kinds of betrayal were coming into the room, relationally, financially, professionally. I was so frustrated. I was implementing grief approaches to deal with their losses because that was the protocol used at the time. But I wasn't seeing recovery from betrayal. And so I began reading everything I could find on recovery, specifically from betrayal. Two obstacles arose back then. They're still present today. First, most of the resources focused on infidelity. Well, the problem with that is, of course, is that betrayal isn't only about infidelity. Secondly, when we think of betrayal, we view it primarily as a loss of trust issue. And because it is a loss, it's treated like grief. But what if moving through the stages of grief, denial, anger, depression, bargaining, and acceptance aren't effectively addressing betrayal? Although in recent years there has been a widening of the lens on how to address betrayal, many resources still support conventional thinking. Back then, I too was dealing with my own betrayal. I started paying close attention to what I was feeling. And then, I'll never forget, the night that I finished working with a client who had been betrayed by his employer, I immediately connected with his feelings. And in that moment, I realized what I was missing, that grief work may fall short of addressing the most important loss of betrayal, the loss of self. And what's tricky about the loss of self is that it's buried in shame. For example, it includes the loss of innocence and identity, the loss of role and reputation, the loss of being seen and of being heard. From that point forward, every time a client said to me, Holly, I feel so betrayed, I asked, what are you feeling? And I paid attention. After 3 years of observation and research, I believed that grief approaches weren't wrong, but in case of addressing betrayal, ineffective. And then I had an idea. What would happen if we considered a different approach? That betrayal was more than a loss of trust issue, and there might be a better path to recovery. Based on my research and experience, when we're going through a betrayal or unearthing a past one, we navigate through three states of being. I call them states of being because this is who we are for a period of time. State of confusion. The first state of being is the state of confusion. When we're betrayed, we want answers to questions. Are any of these familiar? Why? Why would they allow this to happen? Can you help me understand? In my confusion, after the attempted suicides, my mind was spinning with questions. Why? Why would they do this to our family? How do I make sense of this? In the state of confusion, betrayal pulls us outward. We are consumed with trying to understand someone else, consumed with trying to make sense of their choices. In order to begin healing from betrayal, we must turn inward. It is our work to understand ourselves, our work to make sense of our choices. State of worthlessness. The second state of being is the state of worthlessness. Are any of these feelings familiar? I thought I mattered. I gave everything to that job and they just cut me off. Everything's been stolen from me. I don't know who I am anymore. It's so hard. I wake up every morning and realize someone else is more important than me. In my worthlessness, every belief I held about my loving relationship with my father was shattered. I asked myself, who was I as a daughter? Did I matter? What was my worth now? In the state of worthlessness, betrayal pulls us outward. We are desperately searching for our worth, desperately searching for who we are. In order to continue healing from betrayal, we must turn inward. It is our work to rediscover our value, our work to redefine who we are. State of powerlessness. The third state of being is the state of powerlessness. Can you relate to any of these feelings? I can't stand it any longer. I have to do something. It's not fair, it's not right, and no one's doing anything. My life has been completely destroyed, and they just move on like nothing happened. In my powerlessness, in one moment, I was energized, trying to change my reality. The next, I felt defeated. One minute, I was trying to control everything. The next, I felt controlled. One minute, my voice was loud. The next, it was silenced. In the state of powerlessness, betrayal pulls us outward. We are trying to change what happened to us, trying to control everything. In order to continue healing from betrayal, we must turn inward. It is our work to recover our power, our work to reclaim our voice. Since 2008, I've worked with hundreds of individuals implementing techniques for writing themselves, and I've witnessed the recovering journeys. Based on my work, this is important. Grief is the loss of someone or something else. Betrayal is the loss of self. Grief requires that we turn our focus outward as we move through the stages of grief. We accept our losses. Betrayal work requires that we turn our focus inward as we move through the states of being. We recover our losses. 2 months after my father's passing, my family sailed out to Angel Island in the San Francisco Bay. We honored him with a celebration of life. 1 year later, I returned to the same site from ashore, and I reflected on my journey writing myself as I looked at the beautiful shining ocean. First, working on the state of confusion, I ceased trying to make sense of something that did not make sense. I only needed to make sense of my life. And as I did before, I continued making intentional choices on how I wanted to live. Secondly, working on the state of worthlessness, I no longer questioned my worth as a daughter. I grounded myself in my truths. I knew I was a loving daughter. I knew I was loved. And in moving forward, I invested selectively into people and things that validated my worth. Thirdly, working on the state of powerlessness, I let go of what I could not change or control. And instead, I leaned into my work as a therapist, author, and teacher where I could create change. And I could use my voice to help others write themselves. After 12 months of healing work, my capsized mind and body were upright again, only much stronger and more steadfast than before. If you have felt the pain of betrayal, or perhaps you're going through one now, will you choose to recover yourself? Will you choose to right yourself? Because with betrayal, time does not heal, but what you choose to do with your time makes healing possible. Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful conversations there. But then what happens? What happens when you betray yourself? Because we are diving through the emotions of betrayal, right? But what happens when you betray yourself?
November 4th, 2008. It's election night. It's one of those moments in history that people always remember. For my mother's generation, it was where you were when Kennedy was shot. And for my generation, it was where you were when 9/11 happened. And also where you were when this country elected its first black president. And he gave a speech that was about hope more than it was about winning a presidential race. Regardless of your politics, it's a monumental day in our history. That day was 11 years, 1 month, and 3 days ago. I remember that day. Not for politics, I actually didn't even get to vote that day. On November 4th, 2008, the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Department came to my home. They knocked on the door, they came in, and they told me I was under arrest. The youngest of my four boys was home at the time. He was 3 years old. I asked the deputies to let me call someone to take him, but they refused. And I remember he was watching a show called The Wonder Pets, and he had all his stuffed animals in a circle around him when Child Protective Services came to take him away. He was crying, and he ran to me for comfort, but I could not comfort him because my hands were handcuffed behind my back. All I could do in his terror was tell him that these strangers were friends and that everything was going to be okay. I was taken outside where police cars lined the street, and my neighbors were gathered in front of their homes watching the spectacle. You see, I lived in a place where people didn't get arrested. It was Aptos. It was a cul-de-sac in Aptos. And it was my home. I haven't been back to that street in 11 years, 1 month, and 3 days. I was taken to the Santa Cruz County Jail, and I was sobbing, and I was asking the deputy over and over again to tell me where he had taken my son. And he finally stopped, and he turned to me, and he said, "You will never see him again. You should not be anyone's mother. He is better off without you." And I hung my head because in my heart and in my mind and in my soul, I believed that he was right. I was bad. And I was put in a cold holding cell while Obama gave a speech about unyielding hope. And he said, "The road will be long and our climb will be steep, but we will get there. Maybe not 1 year, but we will get there." But I didn't hear any of that. 2 nights later, I wrapped a sheet around my neck and tied it in what I hope was 6 strong knots, and I wrote a letter to my children telling them 3 things. I said that I prayed that addiction never got a hold of them. I told them that I loved them, and I told them that I was sorry. You see, I truly believed in that moment that I had just failed at life, that there would be no redemption for me, but even more so, I didn't believe that I deserved redemption. I believed that I would never see my children again. I believed that hope was a thing reserved for the good and the worthy. And so I hung my head in shame, and then I tried to hang myself. That was 11 years, 1 month, and 1 day ago. Today, finally, I am lifting my head back up. So I'm going to ask you guys to do something. I'd like all of you to close your eyes right now. And I'd like you to think about the worst thing you've ever done. Maybe it's something big, maybe it's something small, maybe it's a crime or just something that went against your personal values. Maybe you lied or stole or betrayed someone you love. Whatever that makes you feel this worst thing you've done, just feel it. Shame, remorse, regret, anger, grief, sadness. Just feel it. Feel the weight of it. Shame is a heavy coat to wear. And regret isn't that comfortable either. So now I want you to open your eyes and I want you to turn to the person to your right. And I want you to tell them the worst thing you've ever done.
I'm kidding. I'm not going to ask you to do that. I saw someone visibly gasp. You know that feeling you just had? That, you know that fear? That's shame. Imagine feeling that way all the time. Imagine building a whole identity out of the worst thing you've ever done. Imagine that when people talked about you, that's all they talked about. When people thought about you, that's all they thought about. And we all do it when we label people. Jerk, criminal, tweaker, junkie, drunk, whatever it is. What I want to say is this. When we label, categorize, and reduce people to the worst thing they've ever done, we are nothing less than the thieves of hope. We are hope robbers. And it's even worse when we do it to ourselves. So as part of a plea deal, I pled guilty to a number of crimes, some of which I did and some of which I didn't. That's the nature of plea deals. But I was guilty. I'd become addicted to opiates. I'd committed crimes, and I hurt a lot of people, my family, my community. I spent a year in the Santa Cruz County Jail. And when I was released, I was jobless, homeless, carless, friendless, childless. The only thing I had in abundance was shame. You see, when I was sentenced, the Santa Cruz Sentinel ran a front page article with this picture and a headline calling me the neighbor from hell. It's a catchy headline. And then while I was incarcerated, someone printed out that article and the hundreds of comments that people had written in response to it, and they mailed it to me anonymously in the jail. And there's not a lot to read in jail or do, so I read them over and over and over again. And I carried those comments in that article around with me, both figuratively and literally, for a really long time, years. So yes, I was once publicly called the neighbor from hell, but now I'd really like today to share with you some other people I have been. Because what I've learned is if you don't believe everything people say about you, you can pretty much do anything. So here's a picture of me from 18 months ago. So unlike that headline here, I'm smiling so big it looks like my head is going to explode. Oprah Winfrey picked a book I co-authored for her book club, and we got to go to New York City and go to CBS for the announcement. And here's a picture of me from 4 years ago. Oh, first she took us out to lunch. Way better than jail food. Here's a picture from 4 years ago, also smiling so big my head's going to pop off. I was lucky enough to be part of a team that got to go to Dharamsala, India, and work on a book called The Book of Joy with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And then the Dalai Lama did my hair. It was a lot of work. Still working. And I'm showing you these pictures. Well, first let me tell you that for the past 9 years, I've been a collaborative writer, which is sort of like a ghostwriter, but different. I've written 12 nonfiction books, 4 New York Times bestsellers, 1 number 1 New York Times bestseller. And I'm telling you this and sharing this not to prove to you that I'm good or even that I'm Oprah good, and not even to prove it to myself anymore, because I spent a lot of time doing that, but just to make the point that we don't know what people are capable of. And when we reduce them and name them and judge them by the worst thing they've ever done, we hurt ourselves, we hurt our community, and we hurt our world. Look, I was guilty, and I should have paid for my crimes, and I did. I believe that people should pay for their crimes. I believe this strongly, but I also believe that we should let them.
There's over 12 million people arrested and jailed every year. There's over 2 million people sitting in prison right now who believe that they are paying for their crimes. What many of them don't realize is that they will pay for those crimes for a lifetime, and so will their families and their children, and sometimes generations pay for those crimes. So what happens when they get out and they think they've paid for a crime? As a condition of the release, they have to get a job. If you get a job, you got to check a box that says you're the worst thing you've ever done, and so you get excluded from that job. You can't rent a house because of a background check. And if you can't rent a house and get a job, well, then you're homeless. If you're homeless, you're 11 times more likely to be incarcerated. And if you're incarcerated, you're 10 times more likely to be homeless. You can't get financial aid if you want to further your education. You can't get professional licenses, vocational licenses. I can write a book with Stanford professors, but the state of California won't let me homeschool my child because of my criminal background. And these restrictions disproportionately burden women who are incarcerated. You can't get food stamps, social services, child care subsidies. We stack up the obstacles and the barriers to reentry, and then we sit in our living rooms and our boardrooms and our committee rooms, and we talk about recidivism rates. We talk about the bad people who keep going in and out of jail. And we all have a part in this. We all do this. We do it in our laws, but we do it in our judgment and in our gossip. We don't need to make it harder, make it impossible for people to become who they really are or who they were. Look, I was lucky. I had a family that loved me, that supported me, that forgave me. But I had something else. I had someone in the community, a man by the name of Doug Abrams, who made the conscious decision to see me as the sum total of my life, not as an addict or a criminal. And he saw all of my life, not just a season of my life. He was able to see my intelligence and my creativity and my work ethic, and he invited me to build with him what is now one of the most successful nonfiction literary agencies in the world. He believed in me until I could believe in myself. And when I worried about my reputation staining his reputation, and I worried about this years ago, and I worried about it again giving this talk, and he said to me what he has always said to me: if people don't want to work with us because of your past, Laura, then we don't want to work with those people. Everyone needs a champion. And don't we all aspire to be that kind of champion? Doug's here tonight, so if you see him, give him a hug. Because he's someone who walks his talk, who lives his ideals. Look, hope can be fragile and brief and fleeting, or it can be something solid. It can be a life preserver we tie around ourselves, we toss to others, or we just share it when people need it most. 11 years, 1 month, and 3 days ago, President Barack Obama said that we have been cynical and fearful and doubtful about what we can achieve. And he asked us all to put our hands on the arc of history and bend it toward the hope of a better day. Look, I've learned that hope and shame cannot coexist. One always has to win. And shame multiplies in isolation. It heals slowly in community, but it multiplies in isolation. Who are we to say that who someone is at their worst is who they are forever? And none of us, individually or as a community, can afford to surrender to the thieves of hope. Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Ramani. Thanks for being here. What is betrayal trauma?
So betrayal trauma is a series of reactions that a person will experience, psychological and emotional reactions that a person will experience after a pretty significant and protracted period of betrayal in a close or significant relationship. So, you know, sort of a classical example of betrayal trauma would be, it's not as simple as just somebody cheated on you, but you come to find out they've been cheating on you for 15 years, or they have a child with this other person, or all those years you, or months or whatever, you suspected they were cheating on you, and you keep bringing it up like, something doesn't feel right. And they're like, don't be ridiculous. And they come up with all these alibis and gaslight and all of that. It's this fallout that comes after somebody who's been significantly betrayed. It could be something that's a public betrayal. You know, that somebody, it's not just an infidelity, but maybe an infidelity with a family member, like you're sleeping with your sister kind of thing, or they're behaving in a really inappropriate way, in a public way that could bring shame upon a family. So, it tends not to be sort of a one-off. It's something that may have been going on for a very long time. And then a person comes to find out there was this whole big story behind the betrayal. It wasn't just this one thing. It was this whole constellation of things that kind of came together. And it's really destabilizing for a person who goes through it.
Is the term or phrase betrayal trauma something that's being used by clinicians, or is this a layman's term?
No, it's something that clinicians use, and I often view betrayal trauma as something that's very tightly linked in with complex trauma. Not necessarily, I mean, it's saying again, complex trauma has some specific kinds of parameters around what that trauma looks like, but if the betrayal trauma is long-term enough, is sort of has this really kind of big wide web around it, that in essence, a person experiencing betrayal trauma will say, I was married to a stranger, or my family member is a stranger, or it's just sort of this what just happened kind of thing.
Yeah.
And a person kind of walking through their life kind of hollowed out, looking like a deer in the headlights, because it's not just as simple as somebody wakes up one day and says, you know what, this marriage isn't working anymore. It's not that. And you're kind of sad and like, where did this come from? But there is no other person. You really, truly did grow apart. This is something very, very different, sort of deceit upon deceit upon deceit.
I understand that. So how does somebody respond differently from a betrayal trauma versus a more standard trauma, like we're getting a divorce? That can be traumatic. That's a big deal.
I think that what gets tricky is, like, again, this word trauma, and without belaboring it, is like, where do we use it? Somebody saying, hey, we've been growing apart for years. Now you want to take this job in a different city. I think we need to talk about, unbraiding this. Is that traumatic? I mean, it's certainly stressful. It's certainly upsetting. I think, though, somebody waking up one day and recognizing that for years their trust has been violated in a fundamental way. What they thought life to be simply wasn't life. Things that they suspected, that almost elevates it a bit more to a trauma, because it's so much. And it can often affect a person's standing in the community and on and on. So I think that the nature of betrayal, that fundamental violation of trust. People growing apart isn't a violation of trust. It's just sort of like things changed.
Yeah. So what are the symptoms, or what types of behaviors would people experience after experiencing betrayal trauma?
So in betrayal trauma, we see a lot of the patterns similar to what we sometimes see in narcissistic abuse: rumination, almost a fixation, and sometimes even an obsessiveness, the focus on the situation. What did I miss? What just happened? Going back, looking at old messages, emails, trying to almost construct it. Where did I not see this, right? It's a sort of a feeling almost like dissociated from your own instincts. Like, how did I see this? Didn't I see this? So like a person literally doubting themselves and blaming themselves sometimes in a really sort of a fundamental way. Tremendous anxiety. A person like, you're on edge. You can't believe this has happened. It's tremendous grief. The life you thought you had, you actually don't have. And so there's this massive shift to like, okay, this was my life last week, and this is my life this week. And how could this be happening? It's confusion. You might even see some of the sort of the patterns you'd see in sort of post-trauma, of sort of a difficulty concentrating, sort of a feeling of being on edge, being very hypervigilant, very aware of everything that's happening. And betrayal trauma can also be complicated, that as the betrayal becomes known, the person may keep getting continually hit with more reports. They'll see something on social media. A friend will say that they saw something. Like then all, if it's a public story, they'll keep having things coming up in the news or the headlines. So it's not like it's one and done. This keeps happening, and a person keeps getting reminded of it. And then again, they may not sleep well and have changes in their appetite. So it's just awful. It feels awful.
I've never experienced betrayal trauma, but I would imagine that I would question everything mm-hmm. afterwards.
Correct.
I wouldn't trust anybody. Mm-hmm. I would go, my boss is probably lying to me. My parents
Correct.
Are probably lying to me.
Yeah, Correct. Yeah. So you've lost all trust in anything, everyone. You become suspicious. Suspiciousness really depletes a lot of our bandwidth, right? Because you're always looking, you can't trust anyone. You're wasting all this time doing due diligence on everything, even
yeah.
people you thought you could trust. And above all else, you stop trusting yourself. And a lot of people going through betrayal trauma feel
trusting.
Foolish. Like, how do I suspected this. I knew this. I let myself be talked out of it. And this is happening repeatedly. And how did I miss it for so many years? And everyone's going to think I'm an idiot because how did I not know this was happening for 10 years? So there's a shame that comes from betrayal trauma as well.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move into some solutions for this. Therapeutic interventions for betrayal trauma. What do we have that you like?
I would say if somebody's going through betrayal trauma, step one is to have a place to vent and talk about it again and again and again. What clinicians need to understand is that these are folks who are experiencing a massive sense of injustice, and there's nothing we can do to make them feel whole. So part of it is letting them, because I do believe that if we let a person say something over and over again, they kind of off gas it. There's like a dialysis that takes place. Because I think over time, unfortunately, a lot of people going through betrayal trauma, a lot of their social supports do get burned out. After a while, like, I cannot listen to this again. Nothing is changing, right? And they may say, like, I just can't do this anymore. Whereas a therapist, that's what they do. And so, and to not judge that. I think that people just need to keep going. And then at some point, even just with the advantage of time, things may shift. But if the betrayal trauma is one where stuff keeps coming up, more revelations are made, it can be a really drawn out process. The other is that the therapy becomes a place to process the grief. A person is grieving a life they thought they had, a relationship they thought they had. It's not like nobody's dead. So this is a very difficult kind of grief. It's something that Pauline Boss sometimes calls ambiguous grief, is this idea of, it's like everyone's saying, okay, I get grief, or they're not dead. You know, you can move on. It would all actually been easier if the person was dead, because then it's not, they're not out there living in their new betrayal future kind of thing. Whereas a person going through this is going through very real grief and will keep saying, I can't believe that life is gone. They can't. I mean, they had a life and now they don't have that life. To really step for a minute and say, what must that feel like? It's almost like having your house burned down. You know, you had a house and now you don't have a house anymore. And so I think that it's very important that in therapy, that grief process gets to unfold, because we often give short shrift to people who are going through betrayal trauma. The world may sometimes look at these as people scorned. Oh, they're just hurt because this person. No, it's much more than that. Like, fundamental truths in their life have been utterly violated. And so it's therapy becomes a very patient process of letting the grief unfold, of empathizing with the client and recognizing that this is an injustice, that there's no magic wand we can wave over this to make it okay. And then simultaneous to that, a lot of betrayal trauma is perpetrated by people who are sociopathic, psychopathic, narcissistic, manipulative. And so some of it becomes the psychoeducation about what those personality styles are. And sometimes that helps people have a framework so they don't feel as lost.
Are there any therapeutic modalities like CBT that you would recommend?
I think one of the challenges becomes is that, you know, CBT is like, change how you think about this, right? The person's like, I don't even know how to think about this, right?
Yeah.
You know, person betrayed you, they've betrayed you. And if it's been going on a long time, it feels terrible. So I do think that just creating a safe holding space, more that we'd see in more of a humanistic style of like letting a person talk it out, I do think an eclectic approach would be absolutely essential here, where you get at some of the historical issues around betrayal. This may be mirroring a betrayal from childhood. Let's say a person's betrayal trauma is around infidelity and their one parent cheated on the other. That could be really bringing up some old stuff. Acceptance and commitment therapy can also become very important, because at the end of the day, this is it, you know, and you sort of have to work with, doesn't mean you're okay with it, but you're going to have to work with that. For folks who may feel very dysregulated, because some people will really get angry. They'll get, you know, again, it's obsessive. They might find that their emotions are out of control. And in some ways, modalities, even though a person going through this. It doesn't mean they have a personality issue, but modalities like dialectical behavioral therapy or DBT, that can also help people sort of deal with sort of bringing in skills like mindfulness and sort of how to think about things, just sort of how to be with this, to be with this kind of betrayal. Yeah. There's some things there that can be quite useful. So I do think that therapists doing this would be drawing from different models. And if a person has a trauma history, it's really important that it be a trauma-informed perspective.
Well, hey, shout out to all of you out there moving through that betrayal trauma.
Stuff.
Goodness gracious. And also shout out to all the supporters out there. You guys play a big role.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for having joined me this evening where we were talking about other people's experiences, where we were experiencing other people and having them go through everything for us, with us, in front of us, so that we could see exactly what this is. So, ladies and gentlemen, I have fast approached the end of the program for today, but before that...
Paife, ohanji mokuyadi, nondaka, ne data, no shoyo o tumarakava hupi, o netwe kaime, okufutarume, okuyingarume, oku japandali, fio papa ndaoka, onda pumga o netwe kaoyo, hai dira dira, ya fange, o mafikwame, ohandi streaming, o mafikwame, ohandi popi, o mafikwame, ohandi nigaishe, poshikanto shime. Pamwina parateza, uinda holora, ameha ishipangere, osho, paumwini. Dira dira, umakota fanoni, data, momkaro wiri, mwana parika, okutuma kutumaraka, okustreaminga, nokudenga pamwina parates. Konga, parates, Namibia.
Always prepare, parates.
And Ling. Alrighty, so I'm saying farewell, I'm saying bye-bye to you, and I'm not saying bye-bye because I don't love you, I'm not saying bye-bye because I want to go, I'm saying bye-bye because it is time, it is time, it is time. So ladies and gentlemen, I say bye-bye, and I will see you again on the other side. Whenever that is, guys, whenever that is, I'll see you on the other side, whenever that is. Might be next year, it might be next week, it might be tomorrow, we don't know, we don't know. But I'll see you on the other side. Bye-bye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary,